Hot 1027 Business with Michael Avery.
Last December, Mimecast, which is a leading global provider of next-generation cloud security and risk management services for email and corporate information, announced its intention to be acquired by Permira, which is a global private equity firm focused on transformational growth at scale. It was a massive deal, $5.8 billion, and the deal has now officially closed towards the back end of May, and Mimecast is private again after a six-year run trading on the NASDAQ and after reporting a 17% increase in top line to a shade over $500 million and net earnings of almost $30 million. It's really a great pleasure to welcome the South African-born and raised CEO and co-founder of Mimecast, Peter Bauer. Welcome to the show.
Michael, thanks for having me.
Now, it's really great to talk to you, firstly, and secondly, to say, you know, what goes through your mind at this time, now that you've been taken private again after this journey that started way back in 2003? What goes through your mind right now?
Yeah, Michael, it's a great question. I think, firstly, for me as a founder in a business, what a privilege it is to be able to found and then lead an organization at this kind of scale over an enduring period like this. You know, so many people set up and start companies, and then through the course of time, the destiny of those organizations is impacted by various things. And you know, founders have to step off or step away, or companies don't always reach their full potential. And so we feel incredibly blessed and fortunate to have had such fantastic investors over the years, had such fantastic team members, and being able to operate in a marketplace where there's real need with a strong business model and continue to innovate and be here today to enjoy this milestone.
And, you know, it's a great South African success story as well, because Mimecast is a household brand name in email security, now cloud security. But I'm not sure how many people are actually aware that this global giant was founded by a South African. Take me back to 2003. Few years after the dot-com bubble burst, and now you've come to start this business with your co-founder, Neil Murray.
Yeah, interesting story. So I left South Africa with my family in 2002. And again, you know, what I like to stress is I wasn't moving away from South Africa as much as I was interested in going to work at the time temporarily in a bigger economy, having built a tech company in South Africa and sold it in the 90s. I really wanted to go and experience a little bit of international business. And so I initially went over to go and sell some South African software and try and develop sales channels for a couple of South African software products. And through that, I met my co-founder. And he and I both felt that the model of selling somebody else's software was suboptimal relative to what we felt we could do together. And he's a fabulous software architect and a really, really bright guy. And, you know, as a co-founding team, we had gently overlapping but very complementary, differentiated skills from each other and very similar values and philosophy about how to build and grow a company. And so in the UK, early 2003, we put together the core ideas for Mimecast and started to gather a small team. Fortunately, we both had some personal financial flexibility from having sold previous tech companies. Mm. And so we were able to start, you know, what with hindsight was a fairly unreasonable journey. We were able to start it on our own terms and prove out some of the early concepts that we thought would be useful. And that's ultimately grown into, you know, a much bigger business today.
And they say in every startup, you need someone who always wants to get stuff done, someone who obsesses over numbers, someone who's honest about the stuff that doesn't work, and someone who's eternally optimistic. Where would you say you rank amongst all of those characteristics?
Gosh, I think optimism is really got to be at the core, because technology is hard to build. Unique technology is hard to build. Next generation technology is hard to build. It requires real imagination and persistence. And you know, my co-founder always spoke about optimistic initiation. If you really knew what was coming your way, you'd probably never start. So you grab hold of that optimism, and you know, taken to its extreme, it's actually sort of a fairly delusional mindset. It's not a reasonable position to be in, but through disciplined pursuit and as you say, those other ingredients, those other capabilities, worrying about getting things done, getting the numbers right, all those multifaceted pieces. But the core is optimism, a belief that there's an issue in the world that we could make better, and we could make it better by applying our time and our effort and our resources consistently over a period of time, and that it's not going to be a quick fix, but that it's worthwhile doing, and fortune will favor the bold.
And here you are in a multi-billion dollar deal with a private equity company, which we'll come to, but I mean, it just shows you what you can achieve if you align that optimism with those ingredients and relentlessly pursue what your vision is. Now, from the UK, you then moved to Boston, Massachusetts in 2011 to lead Mimecast's aggressive push into North America. And since that time, I mean, just look at what Mimecast has achieved. You've been one of the strongest performers in your market segment in terms of customer acquisition and top-line growth. You are now one of only a handful of CEOs to have led a pure software as a service company for 15 plus years. What has this experience taught you about how to grow and scale a SaaS business into new markets?
I think, Michael, a few things. People really matter. You know, who have you got around you, and who are you putting around the good people that you've hired? And you know, it's never going to get this perfect. There's always going to be mistakes. There's always going to be people who let you down. But the success story of Mimecast, I would say, is one of the persistence of a core group of people that has expanded considerably over time, that have been very committed to a few principles. One of those is taking care of customers and making sure that customers are at the center of our business. And that doesn't necessarily mean just listening to everything customers want and doing it. It's really thinking about what's threatening our customers, what's creating risk for our customers, and what is our mission in that equation. And our mission has always been to focus on this most attacked area for organizations, which is email and communications. It is the most interesting point of contact for a cyber adversary. And to focus on a comprehensive set of risks that are faced in that environment, and to do that whilst reducing cost and reducing complexity at the same time. Now, that sounds probably like a lot of industry jargon, and I'm hoping I'm sort of laying it out as clearly as possible. But that simple formula of having people laser focused on reducing risk so that companies can operate successfully on the internet, and doing it at a lower cost and a lower level of complexity than, you know, how customers might otherwise be able to do it. I think that's really at the core. The other side of it, the economic engine of our business, is something that has, I would say, given us the resilience to overcome many setbacks and to have time and space to correct many errors. And what I mean by that is the subscription business model that we have. I often say I wouldn't survive a day as a CEO of a perpetual licensed software company. And that's the environment I grew up in. You know, we used to sell software to companies, and then you'd have a maintenance stream of maybe 10 or 20%. Yeah. But it was this big license hit one after another. The subscription business model is really powerful in that it compounds and it builds over time. And it takes patience in the beginning because it builds slowly. But eventually, if you're looking after your customers and you're offering something compelling to new customers, that staircase of layering every year's revenue. So you're just constantly standing on the shoulders of the giants that came before in building it. And the cash flow profile of the business is really, really strong. So if you have a bad year or a tough situation or whatever it is in the business, you're never falling back behind a certain point.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, very energizing as much as it is reassuring to an organization.
And it's, I'm sure, part of that cash flow, cash generation profile that attracted private equity. It's often what they look for in businesses, beyond, obviously, the right jockey and the business model and timing in the market and that kind of thing. And we'll come to why or how the transaction was initiated. But before that, I just want to talk about the timing more broadly for cybersecurity in this world where, because of COVID, we're forced to, in one of the world's greatest experiments, send entire continents to work from home effectively. And we realized that we could do this fairly efficiently, but it opened up new doors, didn't it, in terms of our threat matrix when it looks at how how organizations are exposing their networks now to potential bad actors. And I think historically most businesses have used a classic perimeter strategy to keep bad emails from making their way into your company mailbox. How has this threat landscape changed to challenge the strategy from where you sit?
Yeah, it's so interesting. You know, this change happened so quickly for organizations. And I think when it initially happened, people thought, okay, well, we'll go back to the way it was kind of soon. I certainly thought that. But here we are, 2022, and we're, you know, I think we're a better workplace. We're still figuring some of this out, but we're a better workplace generally for hybrid work, which is really this combination of in-office work with flexible work from home. And, you know, so it's a much better balance in general. However, there's some serious implications from a cybersecurity point of view. So an environment where people, as you say, were inside a more secure perimeter environment, and IT and cybersecurity people had some level of consistency over the majority of their state and control, suddenly people were working from home. And that meant two things. The one is their technology was at home and in a completely foreign network, but also the human being sitting behind the computer was in a home environment where they didn't have the benefit of being able to validate things, you know, across the office.
Yeah.
They didn't. A lot of the interaction went from being physical, which inherently there's an authentication protocol, if I can use the technical term, in physically shaking someone's hand or looking them in the eye and say, did you ask me to make that payment? When you go into a digital realm, you're reliant on the digital representation of everything. And adversaries understood this very quickly, or they've always understood it, but they understood that they could not capitalize on it more. Because they could show up with emails or with messages or text messages and so on and prompt people to do things, whether that was sharing information, making payments, cooperating with them in some way. And so things got a lot more tricky. And so things like security awareness training, things like messaging security, things like multi-factor authentication became extremely important very, very quickly. And that remains the case.
So how should companies be responding now to ensure that their email, their open doors, so to speak, to the business are better guarded in this new world?
Yeah, I think it's really a case of understanding that an email address is this direct path to the mind and the machine of every single person in your organization, and how incredibly useful that is to a cybersecurity adversary. Because the technology itself can be fallible, and we all know about zero-day vulnerabilities and the opportunity to compromise systems. But we also now understand much better the opportunity to compromise human beings. And email's the sort of dual channel to both of those environments, because you can, it's the only thing in the world where you could write a file to any machine in the company's endpoint network. Because you just need to deliver it via email, and it's more than likely going to get there, and there's a fair chance you can get it open. You can deliver a hyperlink. You can deliver a piece of social engineering content, and the trust and the eyeballs in that environment are pretty clear. So defending this environment is complex because you can't just shut it down. Business depends on the free flow of communication. It's got to be an open network. And so this really requires a comprehensive strategy, and that's really where Mimecast comes into it, by looking at each one of these facets, you know, all of the multitude of ways in which email can be abused. How do we identify where that abuse occurs? How do we baseline what good communication looks like and filter out bad, but absolutely underwrite the flow of good communication? How do we equip end users to make smarter decisions, often in the moment under pressure? Because scammers are clever. They'll utilize urgency. They'll utilize familiarity. They have a near infinite resource of research they can do on a target by this stage, after all of the information breaches that have happened, after all of the sharing people do on social media, LinkedIn, and other environments.
Yeah.
They can appear very familiar and very convincing.
Yeah, and I think that to me has certainly stood out, the level of social engineering and of analysis of the targets to get you to make that decision while you're rushed, dropping the kids at school in the morning, knowing that that'll be your daily routine, to then send through something that you click on while your guard's down and you're not thinking as well as you could be. And often you think, well, we talk about cybersecurity, it'll never happen to me. It's amazing how it can happen even to those who are in the business. Now, coming back to this deal with Permira Funds, I mean, it's a big private equity fund in the US. They've previously backed and helped scale some of the biggest and fastest growing software and cybersecurity and consumer tech businesses globally. Think here the likes of McAfee and Adventa and Genesis. Who initiated this transaction? Take me back to the end of 2021 and how the deal came to fruition.
Yeah, it's it goes back a little bit further than that, even, Michael. For us, plan A was always, let's continue to be a successful public company. And I enjoyed the 6 and a bit years of running a public company. It certainly came with its pressures and, intensity. Mm. But what happened in 2020 is we started to be approached periodically by private equity organizations. And one in particular, and this is all part of our public disclosure documentation. one in particular had approached us a couple of times and put offers in front of our board, and our board wasn't enthusiastic about them and declined them, and that was very that was fine. That firm then moved on from us and acquired our biggest enterprise North American competitor, a firm called Proofpoint. And they paid a really strong multiple for Proofpoint. And what that did almost overnight was drove our stock price up, because it began speculation that we would be, we were undervalued actually in the market, and that there was a lot more to this Mimecast story than people had been perhaps appreciating. And so that started to drive interest. It also coincided at a point with us being added to an index called the S&P 400. It's a sort of mid-cap company index. And that also drove a lot more attention and interest around our stock. But we had a sense that, if we were going to be approached by firms, and we didn't know exactly what the future held, it might be better to go and build some relationships with private equity firms, so that perhaps if it ever came to it, we would be in a position where we were rather able to perhaps make a deal than have to take a deal. Because we'd seen other companies, private equity can be very powerful and very forceful, and not all private equity firms are made equal. So, different management styles fit better with different types of private equity. Different company cultures fit better with different private equity firms. and some are very sort of spreadsheet driven. I mean, they all have a spreadsheet back at in the Batcave, but some of them have, some of them have, there's just different tones in those relationships. And, and for me, that tone really matters. How people feel about their work at the company is a huge impact on long-term outcomes. So we spent some time really getting to know folks, and we met Permira quite early in our process. And we had some, really great bankers working with us too, advising us, and a terrific law firm. And Permira was definitely head and shoulders a good fit for us, culturally, values-wise, the interest that they took. They've been a customer of Mimecast for quite some time. And so, it's complicated taking a public company private. In fact, I had no idea, although I was told frequently by the bankers and the lawyers, this is a complicated process. You know, it's like buying a house, but a million times more complicated.
Yeah, it's more than just getting the gas compliance certification sorted out.
Exactly.
What have you found, just on that point before you continue, what did you find one of the most complex parts of the delisting?
Oh, gosh. You know, the regulations over time have just grown to be very, very complex. So at the core of it, you've got a whole bunch of public company shareholders who, in a worst case scenario, can have a company, let's say, stolen from them by another investor and management colluding with each other.
Yeah.
So that's the fear. The fear is that, you know, that is allowed to happen. And so to prevent that from happening, there is a very, very complicated set of criteria that have to be gone through to make sure that this is very well kind of governed, that the decisions are being made and the ideas are being evaluated in a very structured, transparent, documented way. Everything that's done that you need to remain as sort of privileged and confidential. You've got to have lawyers on the calls with that. And then, of course, you know, we had to live with the reality that when you go into these deals, part of protecting your public shareholders is the deal structured with this idea called a go shop, which I suppose, like buying a house in the UK, you could be gazumped. I don't think we have that sort of law in the US or South Africa, where someone can come in after you've agreed a deal and say, well, here's a better offer.
Yeah.
But it's built in for the protection of the public shareholders and frankly, for the protection of the board to be able to demonstrate that it is an open process.
And it's fair and reasonable.
There's this idea, exactly. There's this idea that, you know, for a 30 or 40 or 45 day period, you can go and look at other offers. So this drags out over quite a long period of time. Now, all the way through this, everybody knows what you're doing. So you're managing staff communications and expectations. You've got customers, you've got partners, you've got competitors who're saying, oh, this could be bad. You know, so it's complex from that. And then to make it more complex, that, you know, the party that had acquired our competitor decided to jump in during the go shop period and put in a competitive bid to sort of see if they could kind of disrupt the process with Permira and gain some benefit for themselves through that exercise. So it's the number of late night long calls with lawyers and bankers, and it went on for months.
I'm sure you're happy now. It sounds almost like when a company's on the other side in financial distress and you're spending all day fielding calls from your bankers and negotiating with suppliers and not really focusing on your customers. It's a similar kind of thing.
Is so much more of a, there's stress with this, but this is so much more of a, I guess, a high class problem. So really empathize with people that are, you know, struggling with distress situations.
But at least now, you know, now that you've said that, now, you know, the deal's gone through, you've gone private, you've got this partner in Permira Funds that is hopefully going to help you scale. And in an environment now that certainly away from the listed market is a little less demanding from the core titus that you have in the listed environment to help you really scale and grow. And, you know, based on your earnings last year and what the purchase price was on a pretty demanding multiple as well. So clearly there's got to be some expected private equity shareholders working with you to drive up those earnings. What are your growth plans and what did Permira bring to the table to help scale Mimecast in this next chapter?
Yeah, again, a great question, Michael. So you know, obviously we feel very good right now, having pulled the ship into a safe port. If one looks at what's going on in the broader market, I've got, you know, friends who are CEOs of still public companies in the Boston area, and I can, you know, you just see their share prices. I mean, these are great companies, but the share prices have fallen, you know, 40, 50, 60%.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's never a lot of fun. And There's no shortage of news streams right now over the past few weeks of companies having to make, let's say, short-term decisions, laying off staff, cutting costs, because the sense is the economy is changing, it's turning. And the one thing that I think, you know, venture firms and these guys appreciated, based on lessons learned in the dot-com crisis and lessons learned in the crisis of 07, 08, and even a little bit in 2014 when things got a little wobbly, was it's easier to cut costs early than to postpone and procrastinate. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of pressure in the system that's almost preempting a recession in the tech space. And I mean, the weather's literally changed in the last few weeks. And a lot of this is because these are companies that are burning cash, are concerned about their next fundraising round, and so on. What's great to be Mimecast, and what's great to be Mimecast in this private setting, is we're not subject to the fluctuations of the stock market and people thinking, oh, gee, the company's worth less now, is it worth more? You know, I don't have public company shareholders angry with me because, you know, they bought it $75 and now it's $65 or something like that. But also because we're a very profitable cash generative business with a patient backer with a long-term perspective on the company, we can continue to lean in and invest. You know, Warren Buffett sort of has this approach in terms of stock market investing. We believe the same in terms of investing in human capacity, investing in building technology.
Yeah.
And Permira came into this with, you know, what I found a very refreshing perspective relative to some of the other private equity firms that I've interacted with. They have a mantra. It's product first, growth first. And that's very different from a sort of cash flow first, margin first, or, you know, whatever you could imagine is in the back of the minds of many others. So they see this as a considerable market opportunity, a significant problem set that faces many companies. And Mimecast today is 40,000 customers. And, you know, to many people, myself included, sometimes it's like, wow, that's a lot. Because, I mean, I can remember when we had 10 customers. but there literally are hundreds of thousands of organizations that we can help. And so getting very heavily invested in going after that and innovating for that and building plenty of much bigger companies out there than Mimecast. So for us to think for a second that, you know, we're at the peak of our growth would be, you know, a miscalculation and a massive failure of imagination. So working with Permira, they bring a lot of, you know, it's not easy to work out how to scale a business from, you know, we have about 650 million of annual recurring revenue. Scaling it up to a billion and a half or beyond, that's not just about finding new customers. It's about expanding into new geographies. It's about adding new products. It's about an evolving team structure and organizational structure. And they bring tremendous experience and access to expertise to us that I think is, and we're seeing it already in terms of accelerating our understanding of, you know, what that transformational journey will be like. And of course, a private equity firm, they're not here forever. you know, my co-founder and I started the business 19 years ago, and I was, you know, fortunate to be, you know, only 29 at the time. So, you know, I've been able to spend 19 years at this, and I've got plenty more time in the tank too, God willing. But, you know, private equity is probably there for, you know, in a typical scenario, somewhere between sort of maybe 4 and 8 years. And
I mean, it's one of those, isn't it, Peter, where it's one of the few relationships that you're ever going to have where before you even really finishing the first date, you're really talking about how you're going to split up. I mean, the exit is one of the most critical parts of the conversation with the private equity firm. And you've got to know what the plan is to avoid any tears down the line.
Yes, I would say it's a little bit like what my co-founder and I always used to say to each other in the beginning, which is, you know, at the start of the journey, it's, look, success will bring many options. We can't become overly fixated on exactly what it's going to be. But we do understand that if we focus on the right things and we grow the company, we will ultimately get to a good place. And you know, when I talk with my Pamira partner, you know, he always talks about, let's build a bigger, but importantly, also a better business. And it is about focusing on those key aspects. And if we do that, for us, plan A, most likely for the company, is that this, it's the one thing we probably have more control over, is that perhaps this company becomes a public company again. Maybe there's a Mimecast public company, you know, 2.0 sometime in our future. And that really allows us to really double down and focus on growth, focus on transformation, focus on building a bigger and also a better business. And then down the line, 4 years, 5 years, 6 years, take a bigger and also a better business back into the public markets. And if not the public markets, there are other options. Likewise, private equity firms. In fact, one of my board members, Aaron Ayn, who's he's actually just retired as the CEO of a company called UKG, a firm he joined in 1978, his brother founded it. He's been under consistent private equity ownership since 2006. So sometimes there are scenarios where private equity firms hang on to companies for a very long time. Of course, that creates some need to provide liquidity to maybe minority shareholders that could be, you know, staff members in the company. So they have to come up with creative mechanisms to address that, which, you know, a stock market would usually do with, you know, you can go sell your stock options or things like that in a public market. So they have to address some of those issues over a long period of time. But, you know, great businesses are good things to own.
Absolutely. And we've seen examples of that in the South African market as well, where some great transactions have been from one private equity fund to another as growth continues under subsequent private equity partnership with the founders still firmly at the helm. It sounds, just as a concluding thought and question, Peter, that you are still very much, you know, at the helm of this business. This isn't a transaction to help you exit at all. You're going to be driving this growth into the foreseeable future.
Yeah, we're excited about it. And I think, just to even pick up on your point about South Africa, there's a South African-ness about our business. Although we're a British headquartered founded company, we run out of North America. North America's our biggest market. South Africa has a very special place in Mimecast's sort of heart and spirit, and also balance sheet, frankly. We do about 10% of our revenues there, a little bit over 10% of our global customers are in South Africa. We have some fabulous customers and brands, you know, I think, as you mentioned. But we also see it as a tremendous talent pool. So we have shifted a bunch of our global functions to actually be serviced and supported out of South Africa. And that's increasing steadily over time. So our employee count in South Africa, I think, is fast approaching 300. Huh. And we have, you know, a lot of our corporate kind of philanthropy is also focused on South Africa. I know, you know, my own personal family philanthropy is too. But we have a tremendous graduate program, and I just want to call this out, where we've developed young graduates, brought them in, trained them up in cybersecurity skills, and put them on the front lines of defending global companies. And that, to me, and I know to a lot of our South African team and my South African colleagues around the globe, it's a very satisfying part of the work that we do too. It adds real meaning to, you know, the craft of building this company.
Wow, and I've always thought that the opportunity for South Africa is in tech for our youth, and to scale that up, servicing global markets. We see business process outsourcing is one of our fastest growing sectors, because if you've got a RAND cost base servicing global clients, we've got the skills. We've got the geography to service large parts of Europe without too much hassle. There is a big opportunity set there. But Peter, we're going to have to leave it there. It's been a real pleasure chatting to you on this momentous occasion. It's just a milestone on your continued path to growing Mimecast, as you said, into a true global giant in the world of cybersecurity in the cloud and beyond. Thanks so much for chatting to us here on Hot Business.
Thanks, Michael.
Hot 102.7 Business with Michael Avery.